The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Life of Flow. Today, we're discussing a topic near and dear to my heart, which is the management, I would say, of CLTI and its conundrum across phases of care and how acute services and chronic outpatient services can coalesce into a better way of potentially managing these patients. For this, we invited today Andro Herrera Mendoza, who is the Chief Growth Officer of Ambulatory and Rehabilitation Services at PAM Health, and also Dr. Mark Davis, who is currently a vascular surgeon at Ascension in the Waco, Texas area. But also Mark was Lucas's first official formal boss out of residency. So it creates some interesting conversations from that. I think these guys are phenomenal, and they give us some pretty in-depth perspectives as to how to manage and navigate this potential issue for patient care. So stick around. I think it's a good one.
Yeah, this is very nuanced, kind of deep in the specifics of things. And I liked it. I loved it.
Very cool. All right, stick around.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Are you avoiding showing your legs because of varicose veins? Worry no more. At Hope Vascular and Podiatry, we have the solution. Our vascular specialists are ready to rid you of those pesky varicose veins. Regain your confidence and enjoy life without complexes. Call 346-400-4673 or visit our website at www.hcic.io. Because at Hope Vascular and Podiatry, the new normal is you better.
We are recording live from Austin, Texas once again. By the way, hopefully, not the last time, but the next time we're going to record in Houston. Yeah. My dear friend Lucas has promised me that he's going to spare me a little bit of the pain. Not that I have anything against Austin, but guys,
you do have something against Austin.
I'm telling you that Houston is such a nicer city. Anyway, I can live without all the hippies around here. guys, I introduced you on the top of the program, and I appreciate you being here today. We were discussing, or we want to sort of delve into the contemporary management of, I guess, wound care through vascular care, or the wounds in the vascular world. I guess that probably refers primarily to chronic limb-threatened ischemia, frail patients, older patients, patients with some comorbidities, and how the management has evolved in a way from what seems to be always this acute setting of care to a more longitudinal setting of care, and what is the right balance between these sites of service, I guess. And you can add into this a lot of things, right? You can add into this the appropriateness of wound care. You can add into this the need for collaborative, multidisciplinary approach. You can add this the minimization of technical, vascular revascularization techniques, and how a lot of that has just simplified, right? And how do you manage this in the setting of then that the incredibly complex layer of healthcare and the business of healthcare, right? Because at the end of the day, whatever it is that you're trying to accomplish needs to be, number one, first and foremost, better for the patient and the right thing for the patient. But number two, it has to be financially sustainable.
Yeah.
And so how do you balance all these things with the complexities of this program? So Mark, maybe I'll pull you in here to start the conversation. You've seen this firsthand, as have I. Lucas, I think, is a little younger than us. And but what's your thoughts as you've kind of maneuvered yourself through different models and systems here in the U.S. and where do you think we are?
So I'll give it on several levels. The first is there's still the push for both, horizontal and vertical integration. And so if you can maintain your contact and care with the patient as they move in and out of the acute setting, I think that's important. And so wound care sits in both that horizontal segment because it's part of your immediate acute care, but also it sits in your vertical segment because it's part of your post-acute care. But it means that you have to be mobile. The patient doesn't necessarily come to you. You have to go to the patient, whether it's in your office, in the wound care center, or perhaps, as Andrew will point out later, in that post-acute setting, either an LTAC or a rehab center. Second thing is, I think you're absolutely right that it's picking the correct therapy for the patient. You know, there's the old data that's out there that suggests that if you're doing sort of gene therapy or something for a chronic wound and you have no other revascularization option, there's a 50% chance you may save the limb with proper wound care. And our own data would suggest something similar for heel ulcers. And I think that wound care has now been shown that in the presence of a vascular surgeon, the number of procedures to affect wound healing goes up. The speed of wound healing goes up. But more interestingly and more importantly, perhaps the diagnosis of what's wrong with the patient who's been referred directly to the wound care center goes up. And so the data that will come out, I believe, probably at VAM this year, will show that it's actually super important that vascular gets involved there at all levels. So seeing the patient, diagnosing the patient, treating the patient. And the beauty of the acute care surgeon in the post-acute setting is you can actually draw them back into the acute setting for a procedure and then return them to that setting. Because vascular surgeons are uniquely equipped with that because we're able to do a little bit of vascular medicine, a little bit of vascular imaging. We can do an endovascular approach or we can do an open approach. And in the holistic approach, perhaps we decide we stop there and just continue with wound care, as you pointed out, in a sort of containing or palliative measure to help that patient out, you know, save life, save limb, but also offer significant quality of life.
I was having a discussion not too long ago with one of my colleagues in Houston about how she viewed the limb preservation, just that whole group of efforts as almost what should be a subspecialty training, and that it should englobe all these other things. And I guess what she was trying to go to is she was somewhat, questioning the value of multidisciplinary care, which I guess will raise some brows and in the setting of saying, you know, I think there should be, and she wasn't necessarily just trying to say like vascular surgeons are like the best. No, she was just saying the vascular surgeon is just equipped in a way to offer unbiased vascular care. But she wanted to take it to the next level. She felt that there was the need to maybe add a couple of years of training to do appropriate foot care, to do appropriate surgical foot interventions, to do Achilles tendon lengthening and to do tendon transfers and to do all of these other skin grafts and maybe micro flaps, free flaps, whatever that entailed. It should be this one surgeon that has the capacity of following that patient through all the complexities from a simple balloon angioplasty to maybe a ointment for the wound, to maybe decide based on MRI if it should be 6 weeks of antibiotics, to then actually all the way to a distal bypass with maybe a flap. And I was I don't personally agree with that. I just thought that was a little bit too far fetched. I think that's
especially with flaps. Yeah, doing like free flaps? No.
Doing everything. Yeah, no. So CLTI demands somebody to be involved from A to Z. And it seems, for me, it seems far-fetched. It seems also rather...
I think it's antiquated. It's this antiquated concept of one person does everything. I think, you know, we operate in systems. We operate in systems of systems. And we need to start learning how to deal with it. And we need to start identifying fragmentation. Like, there's so much fragmentation in post-acute care. There's all these... you know, skilled nursing facilities, rehab centers, LTACs, they all operate independently, extremely difficult to communicate horizontally. So that's the problem. I think, you know, you can have one person that can do everything, but the patient still leaves the hospital. So what are you going to, like, you know, follow this patient to every single LTAC, every single SNF, you know, I don't know. That seems a different solutions.
One of the things that I say frequently, I guess I sound like a broken record, but is that throughout my years on zoning into the limb preservation and just really focusing on that, I realized that the wound care aspect of it, so the longitudinal care of the patient and the vascular care, which in a way should be coordinated to Mark's point, migrated independently, also migrated as different businesses in medicine too. The sites of service got separated. The electronic medical records got separated. The players in the wound care facility, you know, separated. Yes, you can find the guy that is that retired vascular surgeon that goes to the wound care, right? Or that sort of stuff. But it became almost like these separated silos. And then to your point, exactly, then there's this other facilities where a lot of times, I'd say most of the times, these frail patients end up. And we have no idea where they are. Right. But I say we, the ones that are in the acute setting,
yeah,
and there's a disruption. So the business almost is purposely fragmented in a way, or has,
yeah, I think the incentive
purposely or unpurposely, yeah, I don't know, has been fragmented to not create continuity of care throughout throughout all the players. But You know, Andrew, coming from a leadership role at PAM Health, you guys focus on the long term out, you know, the chronic care. What's your perspective on the systems issue? I'm sure you can add a little bit of history of how this whole outpatient care and inpatient rehab and even to the point of home health has been developed, but as a need for the patient, but it also fragments itself from the acute phase of care. And I'd love your perspectives on how this business seems to have been migrated so distantly from each other.
Yeah, I there's a lot of great points here. And I think the primary issue is when you talk about a systemness, right? And how do you unfragment care delivery, episodes of care? You know, I think about the individual who has the episodic care, goes to the short-term acute care setting to get that episode or that intervention addressed. And to your point, you know, they are discharged to some setting. What we do know is, and even if it's just the Medicare population, 40% of them, if they're discharged, end up in a post-acute setting of some sort. So you cannot, to your point, you cannot be at every long-term acute care hospital, every inpatient rehab, every skilled nursing facility, things of that nature. So how do you address and how do you provide continuity of care within an ecosystem where now you're managing the individual's health? And I really think that's where we have to get to, right? We got to create ecosystems about how do you manage the patient throughout the various levels. So yeah, you shouldn't be at every skilled nursing facility, LTAC, rehab. It doesn't make sense. You know, how can you spread yourself across a city like Houston, right? You cannot be in Clear Lake and then Humble or Sugar Land or Texas Med Center efficiently and actually deliver that care. But let me tell you what you can do. And think about in your own practices how this has happened. So if you go to Houston, there's maybe one or two places that are known for what? Aortic surgery, right? These are the places you go for complex aortic surgery. You know, in Austin, you go to this place for, you know, cerebral vascular interventions, because that is the comprehensive center. Not everyone is doing that. And I think it comes down here to wound care too. Not everyone should be essentially doing wound care and further fragmenting, but rather there should be a concentration, a capability, a specialization within certain markets where folks go through, because there is a system of care, because there is a vascular interventionalist that's involved, because they do have a relationship with a system that's providing that level of care, from whether it's LTAC through the home, right? Because there's organizations that all they provide is LTAC, all they provide is rehab, or only home health. I think what makes us unique is that we take that care from the LTAC all the way to home, and then you layer that with even mobile wound care capabilities and visiting practitioners, because let's face it, digital health now is where we're moving to, right? It's a platform of how you get care provided and delivered through a platform. And through that platform, there might be certain services within there to ensure that that individual that you're following to preserve that limb will have the same standard of care, the same order sets, et cetera, throughout, to make sure that they're followed. And then if there is a need to raise a hand to get back to you in the acute care setting, you have that Disney Fast Pass to get there, because you've already familiar with the levels of care. Let's face it, what we've seen in vascular surgery specifically is what? An advent of, I don't necessarily need to do everything at this particular hospital, right? You know, there has been now OBL development. Why? Because it makes sense. Because you can patient center the care delivery at the time that's best for them in the most convenient and most economical way. You know, ambulatory surgery centers. Again, you need OR time, but that maybe that OR time is not available because there's other issues going on. Maybe there's traumas, maybe there's other things, but you can do this in a patient-centered way that allows the individual to get the care they need in a better and more cost-effective setting that is as safe. And it's all about the outcomes, right? And so can you preserve and maintain those outcomes? So when I think about where we have to go to systematize and unfragment, I don't know if it's about the disruptive nature of what we're trying to do, but it's actually going back to basics. Let's create an ecosystem that we manage that population's health through a continuum with the right individuals participating, delivering that care. So I do think, you know, and we have examples where Mark in San Antonio did this. He was able to ensure from the, you know, from the level one trauma center all the way down to the outpatient ambulatory wound care center that patient got cared for. And when they finally reintegrated within to the community, it was either with a healed wound or a post-vascular intervention, whatever that case may be. And there was a positive outcome at a better cost. This is being done in other areas. You're doing this, you know, Miguel in Houston, Luca, you're doing this, you know, within the Austin, you know, MSA. But how do we do this as a standard of practice, and recognizing not everyone should be doing this because they may not be as efficient. They may not be as able to work within these continuities of care systems. How do we do that? How do we institutionalize that in a way that it makes sense? And I think that's all our challenge, right?
So one thing that we I think helps set the tone of the conversation in many ways is the understanding that these patients are patients for life. Mm-hmm. And this has been something interesting, you know, now that I'm out in the community in this independent private model, I've had a lot of conversations, you know, with financial groups and private equity groups for different reasons. And some of them come from, you know, for example, the you know, example, like a vein practice, right? Or a fibroid embolization practice. And so there are these giant conglomerates that have massive outpatient servicing with massive marketing tools. And when we sit down to talk, because they're very intrigued by this business, they are put off by, I would say they don't necessarily understand the value of keeping these patients in the same place. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because there are facilities also that have evolved out of the need for this, right? I mean, this is a need, right? And then when there's a need and there's some financial backing, all sorts of opportunities are going to flourish. Some of them with more vices, some of them, you know, much more thoughtful. But when what has been a problem, I think, is the development of outpatient vascular centers that think that they should provide only acute care mm-hmm. to these models, right? Yeah. All I do is you refer me this patient, I'm going to do the 37227 yeah. atherectomy, stent and balloon angioplasty of the SFA, and done.
Yeah.
Next patient, and we got to get 10 of those a day.
Yeah.
And those are the guys that end up in, you know,
yeah.
in problems, right? Those are the people that end up with Medicare smoking down their RCM. But that for me is essentially wrong. I'm not necessarily thinking it's coming from a wrong place or that everybody's going, you know, that there's a malignancy in everybody that has an OBL, but I think it's short-sighted to think that the OBL is just a site of acute outpatient care for vascular interventions, because it removes completely the thought of longitudinal care of these patients.
But what I think is, like, we try to swim against the current, and I think it's all about incentives. So how do we, like, because currently we have the incentives in place for that to happen. And I truly believe that humans just operate by incentives. So how do we come up with the right incentives to provide good care, to provide longitudinal care, not good care, to provide longitudinal care and comprehensive care where the intervention, the vascular intervention, is just one part. But the big part is wound care. I believe the big part is also nutrition and other lifestyle modifications. That is what got the patient there. Like we forget about what got the patient there. And what got the patient there is what they do, how they move their bodies, how they operate in the world, and what they eat, and to some degree their genetics. So we can't affect the genetics. The other two things we can affect, and we can affect wound care, and we can affect, you know, and we can do angiograms. But the incentives are just modeled to do angiograms, do the 355, whatever, 7. I can't memorize these codes.
You should know how to code at this stage of your career.
Well, I have an app. my phone just tells me what to code.
Mark, yeah. The I don't know if they figured it out, but the nephrologists have been doing this for a long time, right? And I think when we look at this, one thing that we need to understand are chronic complex disease patterns, right? Again, back to, it's not the fibroid, the one and done vein. Mm-hmm. Those are very different. It's the, I think CLTI is more comparable to dialysis, right? And renal failure and heart failure, highly complex, multiple people involved, long-term care, you know, multiple sites of service, ends up in an LTAC, home health care. And I do believe that other disease conditions and specialties like nephrology have, through value-based care programs, attempted to figure out that, attempted to realign the incentives or misincentives, as Lucas may call them. But when you have fragmented institutions and you know, I don't know that is super easy to provide. But Mark, your thoughts on a value-based care program, how far are we from it? Is it doable? And if so, what are the steps to get to it.
So I think you're right. I think dialysis and that population is a perfect example of where the finance, the need, the specialties move together. The Society for Vascular Surgery did try and develop an alternative payment model for CLTI and found it, the problem was it was not sufficiently supported by data, the literature, in the areas that you might have mentioned that we don't have. Two, it's very heterogeneous. And then three, what do you document as your outcome? And so, you know, is it a completely healed wound? Is it a stable wound? Is it a patient who lives at home? Is it a person who's still mobile, but perhaps in some kind of device that offloads or equivalent? And so while it's published and it's out there, it really hasn't moved that far forward. And it's because we still work in the shade to a certain extent. You know, we've talked about area deprivation index and how that might manage, which reflects everything that Lucas talked about. We also haven't really understood that when we talk about even the vascular surgery divisions or wound care divisions or even LTACs, it's a full spectrum. It's not, there's no monoliths there. Everything is slightly different. We don't actually have this truly integrated care of what we want. So I think getting to an alternative payment model will require a little bit more data. I think it'll also require what Medicare has always talked about, which is experiment, please. Show me the what could be done. They've tried that with large major joints. And as you guys know, at Dell, there's this whole idea about when you do back pain or major joints, you want to integrate all these social aspects into it. It may actually diminish your procedural piece, but the patient's full lifespan and their interventions improves. And so I think we're only beginning. I think alternative payment models or equivalent with at the Medicare level probably will not burden us for a while, but will probably not blossom for quite a bit. And I think as we acquire more data, but I think also as we experiment. And so if you think about it, 20 years ago, toe and flow was out there, but now it's more common in many places to see podiatry inside a vascular division because like meets like. And so I think we just have to be patient, experiment, and grow. But I also think that the idea that everything is going to be like an aortic center in an acute hospital is disappeared. I think we will end up with this hybrid-like level where you have you technically as a vascular surgeon, either in a cyber manner or in a physical manner, will move more towards the patient.
And yeah, we talk about these comprehensive centers, and you have this idea that it's, you know, a bigger hospital that has, you know, that where everything gets funneled in. But what I see in the market, both here in Austin and when I go back home to Puerto Rico, is smaller hospitals that don't want to be the, you know, coronary center. So we talk about these centers of excellence, but some market forces are pushing us away from that. And, you know, I just don't see it in reality. When I drive around and I see hospitals, that's not what I'm seeing. So what's the disconnect there?
So I think it's the smaller center or the more entrepreneurial center or someone who's worked outside the classical field is more nimble and perhaps has more resources to get where you need to be. And it's being nimble in the market that's important. Second thing is that you'll often find that these are people who are outside of where they have, shall we say, trained or worked. And so they're not ingrained by inbreeding. They're moving out to somewhere which is more nimble. I think that's super important. The one issue in vascular is cross-fertilization by faculty or residents moving across divisions is very low. Mm. And so and that creates a degree of stickiness rather than nimbleness. We've always done it this way, so this is the way we're going to do it, right? And I think that that's a significant issue. And Andrew can speak to that because in their model is this idea of they don't turn on a dime, but they're not a super tanker that takes days to turn. They watch the market. And I think that that's important that we learn from other people how they do this stuff.
Yeah, I think to your point, Mark and Lucas, is that, you know, when you look at how, and I think of it as a, think of it in terms of how a drug trial, right? Very controlled, this, that, and the other. Then the drug gets into the market. Then post-commercialization, they look at phase four. Oh, look, there's this indication because we've been learning through off-label indications that it has other utility. Well, same thing, you know, you think about vascular surgery, podiatric surgery, things of that nature, is that, you know, I think to some, you know, earlier Miguel mentioned about, you know, vascular, maybe it's the retired vascular surgeon going to the wound center. I think there was some notion that that's probably what it was. I think physicians now have recognized that, look, I have to diversify my portfolio because, to Miguel's point, I am managing this life completely now, right? To some degree, I am the conductor ensuring that whatever their needs are, because they're going to be multidisciplinary. There's going to be renal involvement, cardiology involvement, endocrinology, right? Dietary on the nutrition side. You got to get protein, heal those wounds. But someone has to take ownership to say, you know, for this disruption in your skin integrity down to your bone, who's going to do that? Infectious diseases involved, this, that, and the other. But someone still has to take ownership. And I think as practices evolve from the entrepreneurial mindset, it's that, you know, I'm better if I manage the patient throughout their life versus the transactional side, right? That I'm going to be at the hospital, I'm going to be in the interventional suite, I'm going to do X amount of procedures, I sign out. Out of that, I'll have a surgical indication that I go and do an open procedure. Well, if you're maintaining a population, all those things will occur, but they're going to occur because you're going to time when they occur, and you're going to ensure that you're getting the necessary outcome because now you've identified the timing is appropriate for this to happen, right? And I think that's where we have to get to because, you know, that nimbleness, it's about creating durability, not transaction. It's creating life continuity. And I always go back to this term about an ecosystem. You're creating an ecosystem. That is the disruption. That is what you're seeing because, you know, the thing that it comes to mind is that the number one practice in the world, physician practice, is owned by Optum. 94,000 employed physician plus. They are the number one physician practice in the world. And when you think about that, why did they develop that? They're a payer, they're a care delivery, they do, you know, they have drug access, procedural access, approval access. They're trying to manage the patient throughout their life. And they're doing it through what? Persuasion and influence initially. They're going to layer some protocols. They're going to layer when someone gets something. But who knows that? That is the physician caring for that individual who's assumed that responsibility, that dear individual, you know, I am making these recommendations because this is based on best evidence. And I think that's where I'm seeing the disruption. So when the Optums of the world are thinking that they're creating their ecosystem by employing physicians, I think it's going to be who's going to be most nimble to ensure that they're doing it and really truly providing value, because the notion of value-based care has not been realized. The challenge that organizations are having is how do you effectively operate within that payment model and do it successfully? And then you ask yourself, why are so many people opting out of contract now? Because they're recognizing that Medicare disadvantaged BBC is not what it was all led up to be, right? So, you know, they say Humana Gold, this, that, and the other. It all sounds great. It all sounds great when I go to the grocery store and you sign me up there.
Yeah.
But when you actually need the care delivery, can you attain it? Can you achieve it? And can you do it quickly? Or are you having to wait multiple weeks for approvals for something that you know that needs to happen? And during the course of you waiting for that, that their condition deteriorated. And then it becomes an urgent emergent that you do it anyway because you have to, but the procedure is more complex now versus the initial. So, you know, I think there's a lot of things that we have to do but it all starts with us really taking what we can do, because at the end of the day, all healthcare is local. So what happens in Austin, what happens in Houston, what happens in Puerto Rico or Costa Rica, or where Mark is at right now in San Francisco, is unique. But how do we apply it in a way that makes sense for that population? Because their needs are different and their chronic conditions are different. And, you know, if this is a whole other segment, but, you know, we're going to have to figure out how we do chronic care management, because in many ways, that is the underlying public health issue that we're going to have to eventually address.
So what does the employment model look like? How do you integrate? Because I don't see it happening. If I'm employed by a hospital and you're an outpatient, you know, you are this entity that is trying to navigate the patient in this process, but somebody else is paying my salary, somebody else is giving me different incentives than what you have, then wouldn't that entail that probably some part of these physicians, some part of the vascular surgeons, whoever, should be employed by organizations like PAM?
Yeah, I don't think necessarily, you know, to your point. So let's just say, you know, a physician is employed by hospital as a faculty practice physician, and their goals are to be emergent on call for vascular emergencies and also see patients, right, in the hospital, do consults. I think the way we approach organizations to kind of think outside the box, and I don't know how outside the box it really is we have to create opportunities for that practice to diversify, because, you know, what I think about were someone employed solely by the hospital, it's all inpatient driven. But what happens when your patient discharges? Who's following up with their care? Are you following up with them in a hospital-based practice that they're coming back to you? Maybe, maybe not. But I think where we provide is that, you know, dear hospital who's employing vascular surgeon, let's collaborate, because at the end of the day, these patients, when we identify the needs that require that level of care, we're going to coordinate it back to you. And that's where the incentive comes in, because guess what? If you're an RVU-based physician, all of a sudden, you're having a new source of RVU potential that is coordinating that care back to you. Because once they leave you in the existing model, they could be going to another location and it all starting all over again. But I think the incentive here is that you maintain your patient, you get a new source of opportunity, and other unaligned patients that don't have effective vascular care, now we have a pathway to get them appropriate vascular care. And guess what? You've picked up a new opportunity and you've grown your patient population, because through unaffiliated. That is going to be attractive to the health system, because guess what? They're not having to go out and wait till they come through the ER to try to capture them. Now we're providing a pathway for coordinated care that involves them. And I think this sets them up. Now they're also able to manage their outcomes, because now they know someone is managing that discharge, because we all know within day zero to day 30, if they end up back in your ER, guess what? The payment's already been paid. Now this is new cost. So I think that's where the incentive comes in. The incentive comes in is that I'm going to help you manage your patient. I'm going to make sure they don't bounce back. And I'm going to make sure I raise a hand early, so that way you can get them into an effective setting to care for it without the penalty.
Please, Mark, by all means.
So I also think that there's been a huge focus on mergers and acquisitions, but there's also this sort of undercurrent of collaborations. What do I not want on my campus that someone else can offer me? And in San Antonio, you can see it was publicly announced, University Hospital and PAM work together because they don't have what they want on their campus. And so while you may be employed, there are, as long as your organization agrees that this makes sense to them for various reasons, it generally will occur. And Andrew is right. There's a cash point. There's an RVU point. There's a quality point. But the big issue now is, how can I contain my readmissions? And this has been worked out very well for transplant, where livers, kidneys, VADs move out very early because the hospital sees an immediate hit if they keep people too long on their DRG payment. But if they can get them out to a facility that shares data appropriately, and they can have what people have called externists, that's people who round on these facilities, that works really well. And so again, this is just a different disruption, but it's not in the true M&A sense. It's in this like silent or unsilent collaboration of where people look at their resources and decide what they're going to trim and not trim. And I just want to sort of shout out to one thing. I think if you look at a vascular surgeon, they end up eventually being the primary care doctor for vascular diseases longitudinally. And it's how they integrate that into the patterns of care. It's different in every market, but we are expanding. And you can see from the many things that people talk about at the SVS, about OBLs and stuff like that, that private physicians are moving faster than the classical academic powerhouses. And are adopting models that seem more sensible to the current economic climate. And they're more open to this diversification of modalities.
I was about to ask you that question by saying, who right now is better posed, is better structured to be the ideal caregiver of patients with CLTI? Is it the hospital-based physicians in academic facilities, or is it private physicians that are out there?
I think there's a mixture, of course, with the gray area between the two. But I think that the nimbleness that we see in the market now is not in the hospital. Mm-hmm. The hospital has different politics, right? They're worried about their VADs. They're worried about something else. And CLTI moves further down. I think the nimbleness is going to be outside. And you have your model where you have a podiatrist, wound care, plus a vascular surgeon together. And there are other models like that that are there. And I think those are the models that people will probably gravitate towards. They may not gravitate towards the atherectomy shop, because guess what? The atherectomy shop is in and out, and there's no follow-up. But they may model to someone who can say, this is what we're going to do from 3 or 4 levels of CLTI. I don't know if hospitals, except perhaps those that write a little bit about it, and larger academic medical centers, and even training centers which have fellowships or integrated residencies, are achieving that to a level that makes sense. I think many of those are still 15 years behind, where it's about production, not care. And there's a difference. There's a substantial difference between the two.
I really think that doing a hospital-based center of excellence is doing the patient a disservice. And I say this because I think, again, access to care and geographic access to care and ease in access to care, something as simple as parking, you know, it is impossible. Not only impossible to find a parking spot in the Houston Medical Center, but it is expensive to come. And to think that there is a plethora of my patients that may have to come 3 times a week or every day into a massive facility that's, quote, center of excellence, for me, that is just ludicrous. It is just illogical. And then, okay, remove the patient from the algorithm and put yourself in there. It's horrible, at least this is my own experience, in the last year, trying to be the CLI guy in a massive facility with 6 other vascular surgeons, everybody busy trying to do pulmonary embolisms or, you know, the hepatic artery of a liver transplant that went down, or the VAT that came out and the tubes bleeding all over. Trust me, your toe gangrene is going at 9 p.m.
Yeah.
And you're going to be tumbleweed all day and mistreated in every way, shape, or form that you could possibly think. And honestly, you know, I get really pissed, but I understand, of course, they're going to have to do the heart first before they do the toe thing. But it's ill-prepared. The system is not there. It is not of relevance. It is not financially appropriate for the hospitals. So for everybody out there that are you know, that are putting all these effort, and this goes to you, Lucas. I know that you're trying to, one thing is reorganizing a hospital to try to provide better care for these patients. That's one thing. Trying to put all your cookies in this basket of trying to make the center of excellence for CLTI is just not logical. I think what would be in your best interest is, I'm not saying that you need to, you know, quit your job and go tomorrow and try to rebuild this from the ground up. But what I would do if I was in a big system is I would try to make them realize that these patients should have an outpatient wound care facility that has capabilities of ambulatory surgery center or capabilities of OBL. If you're talking to the C-suite of the hospital, you're probably going to have to sell it with ASC capabilities. But keep those patients there. And then you become the shepherd. And then when that patient needs a popliteal to dorsospinal bypass, you suck it into the hospital and you oversee their care so that there's not 30 people trying to order shit that doesn't have to be ordered.
Yeah.
MRIs being misread left and right, ID changing course of plan, and people working out pulmonary embolisms of people that have had COPD for years, and that's clearly the reason why they're hypoxic. Like, this is what happens. And so then you become the shepherd. You bring that patient up to the acute setting. Your team cares, does what they have to do, and then quickly downgrade, de-escalate, and move them to, again, you know, a facility where you have some degree of coordinated care. Maybe in the ideal setting, you have an APP that can round on these patients when they're at PAM. But then eventually they go back to that outpatient facility that's easy to get to, where they see you all the time. And you're the caregiver, that you're the guy that runs with the ball. That's what the decentralized system, I think, is what's going to work. And here's what I also think. I think here's my premonition that I think as we adopt artificial intelligence, it's going to make us more efficient. So instead of you being able to care for 500 patients, you probably will be able to care for 5,000 patients. If you have all these decentralized systems that have the capacity to have eyes and ears, digital eyes and ears, and you can manage these patients locally, and then there's these critical points of inflection that create a pathway for you to say, hey, that patient needs to come up to the acute setting and then downgrade it again. Yeah. And then this path, but then you're the orchestrator of this beautiful ballet of management of care. And it's not the discombobulated structure where everybody's trying to, you know, and then everybody's, and again, to, yeah, the atherectomy, that just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Who cares? You know, like that's what I think. And I'm not sure that there's a systems incentive for that. But I think that surgeons, especially new surgeons and new generations of surgeons, don't care to be there at 9 p.m. I mean, I threw mm-hmm. the towel already. I don't care to be there at 9 p.m.
Yeah.
And I can do that same dumb case the next day for, to Andrew's point, an eighth of the cost that big hospital is going to charge United Healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still in awe that United Healthcare isn't the person that's helping me move the needle. Andros, don't you think it is the payers that essentially should be stimulating this? Like, it's sometimes crazy for me to think that these OBL codes are kind of fizzling away. Well, what do you want us to do? You want us to go back to the acute care and make this thing super expensive?
Yeah, I think to your point, I think, you know, the payers, and let's be honest, you know, when I find myself, you know, always interested when I see a hospital fighting back with a payer saying, guess what, you know, they're not paying us the rates that we need to provide and deliver the basic care that we're prescribed to provide. So we're going to leave them. We're going to divorce them. And, you know, when you think about it, the three largest payers, you combine them together, it's about $1.7 trillion in their revenue. How do you persuade a payer that has a collective revenue line of $1.7 trillion with a health system that's maybe $300-400 million, right? There's some health systems, yes, a billion or two. It's not a trillion. So how do you persuade that, right? They're going to tell you, great, go out and network. Fine. I can get network adequacy with these four other health systems and obviate you. So do I think the payer has to be part of some type of incentive to recognize it? Absolutely. Do I think they're very good at recognizing that, hey, dear Miguel, I know you can provide this care and do it at an eighth of the cost, and so I'm going to create that fast pass that when patients need that, that they come to you? They have the ability to do that. I'm not sure in their existing model if they created the competency to be to do that quickly and effectively, because they're not as nimble, right? And so what do we have to do? We have to create, you know, data, outcomes, history, demonstrate. And by the time we get to that point where it comes a recognition, guess what? It's already evolved to something else. And I think where we're at these days is I think we continue to have to push and do the right thing by championing for the patient. And when you get the denials that you appeal, that you do it vigorously, and that we should demonstrate the necessity, because what we do know is 70% of those denials get overturned on appeal because they're approved via CMS. And so we know we're doing the right thing. It's we have to somehow continue to challenge that norm. And so that is the disruption there, right? AI is going to help us with that because it's going to help us get data faster, better. It's going to be able to aggregate it in such a way that it makes sense. But, you know, they're doing the same thing to do it for the counter reason, right? to be able to say, you know, we have the data. Yeah. And guess what? Dear, I'm United Healthcare. I'm managing 340 million patients worth of data.
Yeah.
And I can manage it a lot quicker. But I tell you what, there's organizations that I would look to. I think about Epic. Epic has more data. And they are just getting into the space where they're starting to AI their data to start demonstrating, you know, the models of care. And they have the ability, and, you know, Epic, private institution, this, that, and the other, they hold a lot of EMRs, a lot of major systems. They will be able to be disruptive at that nature if they can get it to a point to start being predictive in their outcomes, and that health system X does it better than health system Y. So dear payer, you probably need to go to X versus Y.
So Mark,
I think that we're going to see more of that.
Mark, I see you nodding. What's your thoughts on who's going to be the catalyst here?
So I think there are probably, the payer will always be the catalyst, but we can influence the payer by focusing on what we need, what they want to see. And so when you look at the chronic space in vascular, we've just talked about CLI, but there's also venous and there's also other issues. The data that's out there that they base their recommendations on is not in a journal or a format that allows them to integrate it into their LCD, their NCD, or their equivalent policy. And also, it's always, remember, it takes 7 years to get decent data to the physician's working place, perhaps shortened in some institutions like the Mayo Clinic to 3.5 years. But we may be doing something that will not affect our payer's understanding of care for 10 years. And so, you know, a simple example is Evacor brought out all these new guidelines for care that basically double denials, even though they have a vascular surgeon in charge, because there's no data. And the data, you know, we've always focused in vascular on the large piece, right? The carotid, the aorta, the larger pieces. But guess what? There are 5 times more venous disease. There are 3 times more PAD disease than even CAD. And then out of CAD, there's a lot less carotid and whatever else. And those two diseases are diminishing for various reasons. And the life of the new vascular surgeon is the 4 3 things I've talked about. And you mentioned dialysis. I think that's there as well. And that's where we have to work. But each of those 3 chronic diseases are not acute hospital diseases. They're outside. And the payers want us to move in that direction. But they don't want us to gouge them in that direction. And AI will work in both ways. So AI for aorta, when you scan your aortas, will find you aneurysms, dissections, whatever else. Similar will help. Epic will go where the money is, and the money is going to be care management, where you get a bonus from the payer, or you offer your system a bonus from the payer. And I think that that's where we'll end up. I think we shouldn't look at the payers completely as our adversaries. I think we need to look at them as our pupils who we need to educate significantly, but we have to educate it on several levels. You educate through the review. That's really simple. You know, classical example is the report says there's atherosclerotic disease in the aortic iliac segment. The reviewer who has a 16-year-old or something taking a piece of that segment goes like, there's no mention of stenosis. Well, the AI in radiology needs to put the stenosis there to manage the payer. Second thing is the payer wants to see better data. But they want to see better data, not just in this massive conglomerate medical center. They want to see data out of the OBL, out of the combined systems. And then finally, the payer wants to see, is there value for me working with you? That's a totally different thing. In other words, are you keeping the patient out of expensive places where I don't want to be? Are you not doing a very expensive operation that, I don't want to upset Andrew, but doing a very expensive operation that sends them to an LTAC, right? but then the other thing you have to understand is if you send someone to an LTAC, they have to cover the cost if they come back to visit you. That's the other piece that's important that you don't understand. And so I think working with the payers and educating the payers, in addition to using various pieces of AI, is the way we need to go. But we need to refocus on being nimble, on focusing on the diseases that are growing, not the diseases that are diminishing. And I'll go back to the original point you talked about. Do you need a CLTI fellowship? No. But do you need CLTI education? Yes. And that's not always apparent everywhere, because it's still procedurally based CLTI education. Mm-hmm. It's not comprehensive CLTI education.
Visibility, digital visibility, seems to be this also kind of last mile that could help us integrate our systems, right? I would love to be able to know. I was joking, but not joking the other day. I was like, I feel like some of these legs I'd like to put a GPS on. Because I do all this work and then an ambulance at 2 a.m. takes them wherever the hell they want to go, yeah. Right? And then I've got no control. I have no idea who's there. You know, we may be on some sort of protocol, on a study, research, something, and then the patient ends up with an amputation or maybe an absolutely unnecessary test. And then maybe if I did do something and they did end up in an inpatient rehab, I want to know how they're doing. And then how they got home and when they got home. And, there's all these, there's this lack of visibility from not having EMRs or let's say visibility and communication, right? How great could it be that somebody could just ask me, hey, there's a question about the antiplatelet therapy regimen, or, hey, the patient came out of the bypass, but there's no aspirin or Plavix. The hospital send them home without anything. Like these basic answers, if there was ways that we can better assess that's one thing that I'm scratching my head on. What can I do from my position, right? Where I'm trying to create a decentralized model of outpatient care and I'm still using the hospital or using the inpatient care or using home health. What can become, what can become this one language that allows me visibility into what's happening.
Let's make an app.
Well, I don't know that's that easy, Andrew, but I'm sure you ask yourself this frequently, because I'm sure that what you want to provide for your physicians that send patients there is visibility. So what is your thought from that standpoint as to what tools could we do? Because to your point, yes, I cannot be everywhere.
Yeah, I think, the thing that I think of, and, these are the things that we scratch our heads about, is to your point, is that in 2 a.m. when patient has an acute episode and finds himself in the ER at an unaffiliated facility, getting a workup for whatever that condition is, right? And then they decide it needs this, but they had been seen and been getting good care before that, I think of a couple of things. You know, I think that we're going to have to come up with the true digital passport platform that follows a patient through whatever centers or episodes, right? Not an easy task, but it can be done. The other piece is, I think of other conditions that require navigation. You think of cancer and transplant, right? It's very established, very well established in oncology, cancer navigators, right? Tumor boards, this, that, or the other. And they have an understanding and they follow through care navigators all the way through at all times. So they have an understanding. But what? That's a layer of cost, right? But we're going to have, in chronic care management, we're going to have exactly what it's supposed to be, chronic care management, that there is processes that when patient is having a certain condition, that the navigator who's managing that is aware so they can coordinate their care throughout the various continuums, even in the emergent side, and that they have established ways to get those folks into that pipeline. It can be done. It's going to have to be done on a condition base, right? And you think about what are the conditions that require that. You know, I think for all the key players that are involved in a vascular, you know, with nephrology, cardiology, this, that, or the other, there should be some level of navigation for someone who has, you know, you're trying to preserve a limb. There should be someone saying, you know, this limb, we're trying to preserve it. You know, how do we preserve it? How do we make sure everyone that's involved in that, if they end up somewhere? So, you know, in the past, they've tried through healthcare exchanges, right? Health information exchanges, that if a patient ended up in one ER or another, that there was a common place that you could look up in a record because someone may have been on Cerner versus Epic or whatnot. You know, but not a lot of adoption. I do think we have to come up with that digital platform that it has a passport that allows you to go entry into, you know, there, you know, you're not too far-fetched by saying you should put GPS, right? You know, should we put an Apple tag on person that says, you know, that we follow them and it has their healthcare information, right? You know, we put an RFID on the surgeon when they enter the OR, time in, time out, things of that nature. We got to start figuring out with our chronic care patients, how do we digitize their ability to ensure that whatever's going to be done, it's right. Is it through a bracelet that has the information and that it can be scanned? We put tags in our pets so they don't get lost. We got to figure something out. I think the digital way to do that, the passport, to make it have utility. But and to the other degree, it's got to be able to communicate at the different places, right? And so that's where we have to get to. Are we getting there? No. But I do think that me working with certain physicians that I know that have certain population, my goal is to create a pathway for that coordinated care. Because you know what? Miguel doesn't have to always be in our facility, but his APP or PA should be, you know, involved. That externness. And then that way he's able to touch more lives efficiently as the conductor, and that you have that. Lucas should have that. Mark should have that. You should have your externists that are in the right environments, but they're channeling because you can control that flow of information through your externists. And we can get there. But it's going to take all of us working together to do that. And this is where the geopolitics kind of has to blur, because we're going to have non-traditional relationships that maybe we hadn't fostered or thought about before. But we're going to all be successful to do this right. And that's, I think, where my passion is at, is how can we do this together and create a unified ecosystem that supports the populations we're trying to serve? Because at the end of the day, it's our privilege to be able to do that.
So, Mark.
So I'd add three things. One, CLTI or equivalent wound patients are really high cost, high need. They have other comorbidities that need to be managed. Two, many of the companies have silent EMRs. That is that they've collected all the data from Cerner, Epic, whatever, and they're putting it into their own EMR. But we don't have access to that because they see control of information and provision of information as the way to control their cost and the management of the patient. If you look at an example, Oscar, which is a completely digital company, only works in certain markets. they assign nearly 3 caretakers to every patient. And you're expected to call before you go somewhere. And then they send the patient there. So it's not a GPS or a tag, but it's equivalent. And they make sure that if they identify someone who's diminishing in some diminish of whatever domain they're following, that they get them to that patient during daylight hours. And so that they have their management structure. And then you, if you're looking at about portability of health information, EMRs are designed as a barrier to exit. They're not designed as a barrier to entry. And so they're trying to keep the data, the patient, and everything else in. And we've never solved that problem. But in Israel, Maccabi gives their patients all their data on a credit card. And you can go anywhere. And as long as you have the opening piece for the credit card, your information travels with you. So you don't need the MRI. You don't need to do a new MRI if the guy had an MRI a week ago, because it's already in the card. And so there are examples, but a lot of it is pushed by market pressures, either to contain the volume, hurt the competitor, and how much of it is truly patient-focused is not necessarily pure. It's a market. And so I think that one needs to look at it as creating CLTI, venous, whatever, as high-cost, high-need patients, and then integrate it from there. Caretakers, navigators, then whatever, the concierge doctor that looks after them, that needs to be developed. And it will come, but I think, you know, CLTI is, you know, a way to control cost for a lot of providers, you know, because an example, if you save an amputation, you may have someone who can still go back to work. You may have someone who doesn't spend a ton of time after rehab in a place, but they can do other things. But that's cost we've never, it's cost we don't really readily identify so well, because the other comorbidities of the patient may prevent them from getting where they need to be. And going back to what Lucas talked about, there is a preventative aspect that we need to push. Where we're, and Rand talked about this a long time ago. There are 5 or 6 things in the U.S. population's activities that they do not do that costs us a third of our healthcare budget. And we also have to be there. And that's perhaps where social media, where presence, where everything else needs to be out there to move it along.
Mark, do you think, as we get close to the end, do you think that there are that there could be possible funding to run some of these pilot projects? I'm talking about grants that could be along the lines to Andrew's thought process of, because you know, I would love to hire a, you know, peloton of navigators for my patients, but the reality is that's a line item that I can't pay for, and nobody's going to pay it for me. But could I potentially get a dollar or two from grants where I'm saying, hey, here's what I'm trying to propose as a disruption in the model of care, decentralized, coordinated care amongst different institutions, where I'm creating the alliances and the fluidity and the exchange of information, and then find the right appropriate outcomes and the performance goals to then come back and show that. Because I don't know that I'll have the capabilities even 7 years from now to show that what we're doing works, because you know, for a payer to even look at it's about numbers, right? We'd have to have 100 or 500 hope institutions and thousands of patients for somebody to even look at us before we could sit down. But can we harvest that via some institutional grants?
So I think there are 4 or 5 levels of where you can get the grants. And the first one is PCORI, which is the Patient-Centered Institute at the NIH, does want to see this kind of level of care. Yes, that's probably more data-driven, but it's definitely there. Second, CMS has experimental grants where they want people to try new models of care. I think payers, which was seen in the Texas Medical Center 10 years ago, where if you bump your quality up, they pay attention. And they may not give you a grant, but they give you a preferential payment, which is different. And it's not related to the classical APMs or anything else. It's you're on a different tier because you're offering a better set of care. So Memorial Hermann for 10 years was superior to the other players in the med center because of that. And then I think one could look at the SAVE Clinic in San Antonio, which is Lisa Choa, where a lot of her care navigation population-based money is actually coming from the city, because the city has identified that managing their population that's a high need to them, either to their healthcare system or to other equivalents inside their system, it's worthwhile for them to donate. Now, those grants are maybe dependent on the politics of the city to a certain extent, but the cities are interested in managing their populations and perhaps have more grants than you would realize. It's how you couch it that gets there. And then the last piece, which is popular but difficult, is philanthropy. And so it's finding that one person or several groups that believe that this is the place to go. And it's about, you know, looking after the holistic part of the patient rather than the toe of the patient. And that's what you're describing, which is a holistic approach, which is for a high cost, high need patient is super important.
Well, gentlemen, we asked for an hour and I think we've gobbled it all up with some pretty cool conversations, spicy ones, but also landing it at a place of we have a lot of work to do, but some great ideas and certainly the conversation being fluid and having you guys here on board is just going to hopefully entice a lot more people to figure this out. So I appreciate you both on a Sunday, super Sunday morning. Thank you very much for that. And I hope that we can have you here in another show sometime in the future, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay, Andrew. Okay, Mark. Bye-bye.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.